Hey everyone, and welcome to Lighter Impact, the podcast that explores the intersection of social impact, somatics, and spirituality. Whether you're an entrepreneur, activist, or simply someone looking to make a difference, this podcast will provide you with insights and tools needed to make an impact in the world and feel lighter doing it. So sit back, relax, and let's see where this journey takes us. Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's podcast. I'm so excited to introduce you to my guest, Timreese Khan, an independent development professional and researcher with over 25 years of experience in international development. She's currently based in Pakistan, with her work focusing on social policy, aid effectiveness, gender, and global migration. Timreese actively speaks, writes, and advises the global community on notions of decolonization, North-South power imbalances in development, race relations, immigrant citizenship, and integration. And most recently, she co-edited the book, White Saviorism in International Development: Theories, Practices, and Lived Experiences. Thank you so much for joining me today, Timreese. Welcome.
Hi, Basan. Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to kick things off, I'd like to start with the question of impact and how your understanding of impact has changed over time on your own journey.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think it would depend a lot on how one defines impact, and impact of what on what. So in that sense, it's a very broad, it's a very broad view. But in my own personal journey, it's hard. I mean, as I think aloud, when I started off my career in the in this field of international development, it's been close to 30 years now. It was all about changing the lives of my own people and making things better in my own country, in Pakistan. So there was that feeling and that need to make a positive contribution for the people of Pakistan through whatever I did. And what I did just happened to be working with the international donor community on aid funded projects. And as I went along in my career, it was very both interesting and difficult to see the trajectory of both my career as well as the sector as a whole in the country. It was an incredibly donor-led sector, with our own government most of the time taking a back seat and just going along with whatever was being asked of them to do. And in the second part of my career, I actually became an evaluator, a project and program evaluator. So looking at impact was one of the key components of my work. And it was a very micro-level impact of that particular project or program that was under evaluation by a foreign donor agency, no less. So during that time, things started to dawn on me that the type of impact that I was looking to have via my work on the people of my country or certain conditions of my country in different sectors was not happening the way I was envisioning it. For instance, I worked a lot in gender and with women. The change that I was witnessing was not complementary to the change that was being, promoted. So the situation for women was not becoming as positive as we said that it would be as a result of the work that we were doing. So that's when I started to think differently about, the impact, quote-unquote, the sector was having as a whole on Pakistan, as well as my own contribution to the sector, or the lack of it, the lack of impact. And that's ultimately when, many years later, I decided to quit the sector altogether, because I felt that the sector itself had not been able to make a meaningful impact And you can define meaningful in many, many different ways. That's a loaded term itself. But also that my own contributions to the sector were not having the intended effect that I hoped they would have. So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. And I, you know, this idea of starting in the international development sector with this goal of changing lives of your own people, and then realizing that, no, that's not going to work, and making this decision to quit the sector altogether is really powerful, because I think I've talked to a lot of young professionals who start out starry-eyed and then get disillusioned but don't know what to do with it. So can you just share a bit more about this decision to quit the sector altogether, which would probably take us to the journey you are on now as a researcher?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I think one thing I need to clarify is when I say I've quit the sector, it's not as black and white as it sounds, because in many ways I'm still in the sector. One of the reasons I'm speaking to you is because, you know, indirectly I'm still in the sector. I may not be part of the system anymore. So what I chose to quit was that I chose to stop doing the work that I was doing, which was all donor-funded, donor-led, very mechanical and pedantic work that international aid assistance makes you do. So I no longer take on work that has anything to do with, you know, with a donor-funded program or project. But what I am still doing in the sector is working outside of it. So I'm raising the same issues that I have been working on all these decades. So about women's rights and about financial inclusion and about equal rights for all, minority rights, you know, what have you. Basic human rights, really. I'm still doing all that and I'm still talking about that, but I'm talking about it outside the system. And in some cases, I'm talking about it with the system. So that's the difference. So I've quit the very tangible outcomes that the system gives you in terms of, you know, monetary benefits, for instance. But instead, I'm now working outside the system, talking against the system, most definitely. But in some cases, trying to talk with the system as well. Because if you want to change the system, at some point, you have to, I guess, keep the communication lines going, but I'm very selective about that, about who I do that with and on what platforms and on what basis and on what terms. So I think that, for me, for a lot of people who may want to leave the system, and I've just been observing very anecdotally over the last couple of years, that there are a lot of people like me who are now choosing to take this path, which is very encouraging to me as well, because, you know, strength in numbers. You tend to feel a little sort of singled out when people say, you quit the system, you know, you quit development. And so you say, well, I'm not the only one, you know, other people are also going down that path. But I chose to work outside of it. And for me, that it's the freedom of being who I am, saying what I want to without that pressure on me of being accountable or subservient to a system that I am not in favor of anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And it's going back to that idea of impact. It's like, as you've been on this journey, it sounds like now the most impact that you can actually make to help your people and to change lives is by speaking out against the system, researching the system, and putting really powerful language to terms that I think a lot of people in the international development sector notice or even feel in their body, but can't articulate it as clearly as you have in your own research. So I want to hone in on this concept of white saviorism. And I'm curious about how this topic has become prominent in your own life.
So that story started about a couple of years ago. And my co-editors and I, Dr. Michael Sandavji and Dr. Panakulya Dixon from Uganda, from Canada and Uganda respectively. And it was really their credit to them. It was their idea that brought this book to fruition, that, you know, we talk a lot about the failures of international development, but we never talk about this concept of the impact the white world has had on the non-white world when it comes to international development. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, racism and power imbalances between countries. But in the field of international development, where we're talking about aid assistance and we're talking about, you know, we throw around the terms equality a lot and human rights, there's still this subservience to the white way of doing things. So we were very interested in trying to unpack this idea of the white savior industrial complex, which Tehu Cole had actually coined this term in his 2012 article in The Atlantic, and try and see how it applied to the international aid industry in particular. So it was very interesting because we don't really use the term white savior complex or white saviorism in our language of international development at all. Yet the mechanics, the modalities, the interpersonal dynamics of the sector between aid giver and aid recipient is all about white saviorism. So it's the white person coming from the white country to the non-white country and saying, we are here to help you save yourselves from yourselves. And I realized that myself, because that basically brought into perspective, you know, all the decades that I had been working in this field. I'm like, oh my God, it's right. So many people that I have worked with in this industry had that exact attitude. I mean, they never said it. They never used those words. But that is it. When I started to think back, and so that was it. I was like, yes, let's do this book. And we were very, very fortunate to have a fantastic group of authors, all from non-white countries, and or who were non-white origin in white countries, come together and share their experiences of exactly this in the aid sector. And it's been a very, very powerful concept that has now resonated amongst the aid industry, and majority of our response has been from the white aid sector, because suddenly we're calling them out for being white saviors, and they're like, what? I mean, this is a term they even hadn't ever been exposed to. And you're saying, well, yes, this is what you actually are, and this is the reality of who you are.
And that's the power of language, especially well-researched, articulate language that can help people understand what's happening around them that doesn't feel right. Like in my own experience in the international development sector, I think people know that something is off, but when the system is working in such a way that's so large and has so much inertia behind it, I think, like in my own experience, when I was in international development, it was a very short stint, but I was like, I must be doing something wrong, because it feels like everyone else is going with the flow. So again, it's just the book, the language, the themes that you and your colleagues were able to so articulately pull out, I think is going to influence a lot of people. Which brings me to the question, how has it been received by either institutions or individuals around the world? I'm curious if you could share some stories.
It's been received fantastically. I mean, we always, not to sound, you know, overconfident, we always thought the book would do well because there is space for a discussion like this, but we had no idea it would do so well. So it's literally, I mean, for us, you know, this was a small independent publisher, the Raja Press, who published this for us. And, you know, we really didn't have much money behind it at all. It was, you know, a 2-year labor of love for the three of us. And we were just completely blown away by the response. It's been tremendous. it really has been tremendous. I mean, we've had events around the book in Pakistan to a lesser extent, but Uganda, the UK, and then Canada just very recently, where literally the book has started conversations of all sorts. And we have not suggested any solutions in the book because, I mean, this is what everybody asks. So what's the solution? And there is, you know, we don't know because we haven't even had these discussions yet. We haven't even started talking about things in deep mode. We're still scratching the surface of so many issues. So solutions are far away. And so the book doesn't give solutions, but the fact that it struck a chord with so many people, particularly in the white aid industry, is huge. And that is, I think, a huge achievement for us because they were the ones, you know, we wished to target the most. We've also had a very good response from activists and aid workers and professionals in other countries as well. And we just hope that it keeps a conversation going. Obviously, a lot of people may not agree with us as well or what our authors say. It's a very hard pill to swallow. We are all of different perspectives. Not all of us agree with each other, even within our authorship. But this is an open mic call. This is for people to talk about their particular experiences. And I think that's the type of discussion that we need going. One in which people don't always agree, which is good, because we need to see where the disagreements are then. But it's been tremendous. It's been tremendous. And if it has stepped on some toes, which I'm sure it has, that's also part of our job done, you know. And we hope to come out soon with another reprint because it's been fantastic. First run for us in the last few months alone. So it's had a tremendous response. We just hope that this is taken further to build more conversations within institutions. That's something we don't have control over. Our job is done by having the book out and all the experiences of our authors out in it. So we hope in the next phase, this takes on a slightly larger life, which gives us impetus to see really what impact, there's that word again, the book has had, positive or negative.
And this idea of people looking for solutions and you and the authors being very intentional about, actually, let's start the conversation. Let's talk about what we've seen in this articulate way so that we can go from there, I think is very intentional and against the grain, right? Like everyone wants the article that says it's 5 ways to, you know, stop white saviorism. Yeah.
But that's right.
We can't always produce that, at least not in with any quality. But I do think that the one recommendation that comes through loud and clear in the book is the importance of listening. And the responsibility that international development practitioners have to listen to communities. And I'm curious from your experience, why is this so difficult?
That's a great question. I mean, I think everybody feels that they have a right to be listened to. And I use the word listened to, not heard, because there's a difference between that, between hearing and between listening. So for instance, a lot of people may be hearing what myself and others have to say about the system and its inequalities, but they're not listening, because listening implies you're actually making an effort to understand what's being said. You know, hearing is you can hear from one ear and take it out the other, you know, and it never happened. And a lot of people are doing that, right? And the acknowledgement that they say, oh, yeah, we hear you out there. Sure, you hear us, but you're not actually listening to what we are saying. And part of that, I mean, I've had a lot of sort of, you know, slightly uncomfortable and unpleasant conversations where there is pushback against what you're saying. And that pushback is like, yes, but, you know, we have a perspective too. And my point is, well, you've had a perspective pretty much our entire lives. And now it's our turn. So I think the idea is you need to keep pushing through that. You need to keep pushing through the pushback that you get, the what ifs. So when now everyone asks me, and even earlier, you know, okay, so what do we do? What's the answer to this? I said, that's not my problem. Not my problem as an individual to give you an answer. It's not my responsibility as an individual. It's not my responsibility as, you know, an aid recipient or a member of the Global South. That's on you, right? That's on you. You know, like a lot of people use the term, you know, you broke it, you fix it. Why do we have to be responsible for giving all the solutions to the problems that you have created? Why do we have to sit there and listen to you justifying or trying to, show the other side when that's all we've seen our entire lives? So it's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge trying to stay calm in a situation where people have also told me that, you know, you all are very angry. I mean, not me specifically, but, you know, to those like myself, that, you know, you shouldn't be so angry because then it doesn't take the conversation forward. You need to channel your anger. And I sort of just, you know, I'm at a loss for words. And I say, our entire lives, you've told us what we need to do. And now you're even taking away the right of us to be angry about that. You know, we have every right to be angry and we have every right to push back against whatever justification you're giving us because we're done with it. So for me, that's, I think it's a matter of us now deciding, and by us, I mean, you know, those of us who've been on the receiving end of aid, to decide where we want to be. Do we still want to be constantly managed and told that, no, this is, you're not doing this the right way? Or do we just want to completely break through all that and say, okay, enough is enough? You know, we want things to change and we want things to change our way now. You've tried your way, now give us the chance and give us the mic.
Yeah, this idea of giving us the mic and not expecting a solution from day one is really resonating with me, because we're not allowed to talk about what isn't working if we can't fix it in the same sentence most of the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, what would you say to other peers who are on the receiving end of aid, who might be afraid to speak out, who might feel like this is going to come across as complaining or too radical for development agencies that are in their country?
Keep speaking. I mean, I understand the risks of speaking out completely. I didn't speak out for the longest time. My entire career, I didn't speak out. I was literally one of those people who went along with everything. Part of it because I genuinely believed what I was doing was the right thing to do. But part of it also because, you know, the system is geared to keep you quiet. So I completely understand people who are afraid to speak up. And I wouldn't want to put anyone in an uncomfortable position because everybody's circumstances are different. But I guess what I would say is that if you have the opportunity to speak up, and if you really, really at this point of our lives, when literally the world is burning up around us, and I don't mean that in terms of climate change, I mean politically, economically, socially, you know, that the world is literally burning up around us. If we don't speak out now, then when do we speak out? There are ways to speak out as well. I've chosen a fairly aggressive way. Others can choose perhaps a more less aggressive way that suits them. But do speak out somehow or the other. You can speak out not just through words, but through actions. And keep resisting. That's something I would love to sort of tell people who are in the system and are finding problems with it. You've got to keep resisting, because if you keep quiet, you are festering the same issues and they will never get resolved. They will never come to the fore. It's a slow process. It's an individual process, right? You can't force individuals to do things they're going to be uncomfortable with. And I know that sounds like a really oxymoron and ironic statement, because here we are trying to force, you know, the aid system to do things that they're not comfortable with. So I know that sounds like a really contradiction in terms, which it is in a way, and it isn't. But you've got to keep resisting somehow or the other. If you're not happy with a particular way a project or a program is going, you've got to speak out. Even if you're not heard, even if nothing comes of it, but at least let your conscience be clear that you did as much as you could. Because I do understand this is a humongous system. It's a global system. We can't break through it as one person. But I think if more of us started to come out of our shells, and I think a lot of us are, because in a way, these conversations that we're having, we could never even think of having them as early as 5 years ago. You know, we could never even dream of talking about the things that we're talking about up to as early as 5 years ago. And now we are. So I think that's a really encouraging sign. Where it's going to lead, I don't know yet. But if we want it to lead somewhere, then we've got to keep the momentum going. And that momentum means that you have to figure out to what extent you want to go to be able to be heard or listened to.
And each individual figuring out what that means for them in their own context, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. So people who have more privilege, have more opportunity, and feel this way and see the same things that you're naming, this white saviorism, for them to take that opportunity to speak is important. And I also, to me, is what you said about, you know, you chose an aggressive way and other people might not choose as an aggressive way. I don't think it's aggressive. I think what you've chosen is a very well-researched, articulate way.
I guess when I say aggressive, I mean, like, you know, when I'm talking on a one-to-one basis, you know, I mean, my research is my research, you know, what gets published. I have to, you know, that's a different way of doing things. But when you're actually speaking one-on-one, and I think that's where the real change comes, when you're interacting with people, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, I think your passion has to show through about how you're feeling about certain things. So that's what I mean by, you know, a more aggressive approach, in the sense that, you know, you can't back down if somebody's mm-hmm. trying to push you. You know, you say fearlessly, as fearlessly as is possible for you, what, you know, what is in your heart and what you want to say. So that's, I guess, what I meant by, you know, I've chosen an aggressive approach outside my research, I guess.
Yeah. And each person is going to talk in their own way. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I've really started to truly appreciate at this stage in my career, in my life, is, you know, how you would be presenting white saviorism to someone is going to be fundamentally different than how I might be presenting it to someone, or how someone else might be presenting it.
Right.
And it's each of us having these honest conversations from a place of congruence internally, where we understand how we're implicated, we understand what our role is. Mm-hmm. And speaking from there, I think, is what is going to move this conversation forward. Mm-hmm. Which brings me to the question of white allies. Mm-hmm. And white allies specifically in the international development space, who might be working for an organization, don't want to be implicated, actually are, I'll even go as far to say that they think that the organization that they're working for is not falling under this white saviorism complex. What might you say to that person?
So you mean those, when you say who feel that their organizations may not be falling under the white saviorism complex, do you mean to say like they genuinely think those organizations are, they're doing the right thing, or because they just don't want to admit that their organizations...
Well, I think it's both. I think it's okay. Both of those. I'll give a more specific example. I recently had a conversation with a nonprofit that's looking to expand to Palestine.
Okay.
And previously they were working in Afghanistan. And now with the nonprofit being unable to operate there, they're like, oh, where can we go that is similar to Afghanistan, and they picked Palestine. Right.
Oh my God.
And the funny thing to me is Palestine already has local solutions that are doing exactly what this nonprofit, this INGO, is doing. And when I pointed this out to the person I was talking to, they were like, oh, but we hire local staff.
Yeah, to those sort of people, I mean, I would just say, yeah, this is wrong. This is that everything that is wrong with the sector, right? The idea that you can flit from country to country, the idea that you can pick and choose according to your preference, the idea that you are actually trying to take benefit of some of the worst conflicts and human rights abuses in the world, and you're looking at it as if it's just, you know, a point on the map. I think that is completely wrong. I mean, again, me being aggressive is you shouldn't be in this sector at all. Like, if that's the type of person, that's how you're thinking, that's the type of organization that's thinking that way, I don't want you in my country. Right? And that's what I think the pushback from our side should be then. It should be from countries who are saying, you know, we don't want you here if this is what you think of us. And I think that's where the voice should come from then. The voice should come from those quote-unquote recipient countries in Afghanistan or in Palestine saying, we don't want you here because we're not your guinea pigs. We're not here for you to benefit. But that's, I mean, who's going to listen to them? Every conflict is different. And these two conflicts in particular that you mentioned are the most, two of the most extreme conflicts happening right now in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that is a, yeah, no, that's not right.
And what made me so upset about that conversation was I knew that this INGO could raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm. And I know the local grassroots organizations in Palestine who I have first-handedly tried to support them in their fundraising efforts and struggle to raise the 50K.
See, that's the whole idea of, look, some countries, every country has the local, every country, okay, let's not use the word local because that's also a very sort of loaded word, you know, that has now been, in a way, it's a buzzword. Let's just say that every country in the world has its own system of doing something, right? That the aid system is doing. So I use Pakistan as an example, and I've written about this, that we have our own systems. I mean, our state systems may be a mess, but we have alternate systems, homegrown systems that are working in health, education, women, humanitarian, all the sectors that the international aid industry wants to jump into. We have our own solutions for that. We created them ourselves without anyone else's help. And I think that's what irks the international system, because they want to come in and create their own system. So they come in and they completely ignore and sideline what already exists there. And they want to create their own little way of doing things by saying that there is no capacity, or no, they won't be able to raise the money. And if we're not there, people are going to die hungry, or, you know, this won't happen or that won't happen. I mean, in certain extreme cases, whatever you do, things will not happen because of the extreme situation, right, which requires a much higher level global response. But the idea that you think that there is absolutely no ability in these countries to organize themselves and to meet their own need, to me, is the biggest insult of all. And we still have in this day and age, despite these conversations, the belief that there actually is no, to use that dreaded word, capacity in many countries. And I am flabbergasted at how people can still think that.
Especially in this digital age, you know? And this is one of my frustrations with international development, is it's operating the same way it was operating before the digital age. And it's like, no, it's a simple Google search is all you really need these days. Maybe in 1970, they weren't able to connect with those grassroots, homegrown solutions. But today you definitely can.
But I think that's the fear. I think that's the fear that, because I've seen a lot of co-optation happening in my career. And that was, we used to work with exactly these sort of small village level organizations where you used to have, you know, fantastic work happening without any resources in terms of girls' education or farming techniques or, you know, community-based financing techniques. And suddenly a donor used to catch wind of them, used to sort of just fly in and take over the entire exercise, saying, okay, we'll help you make it bigger and better. And that was it. That community exercise and the community part of it was gone. It was completely taken over by the donor. And I'm ashamed to say I've been part of those exercises. But that's just it. Everything that actually is occurring on a very homegrown basis is at risk of being co-opted by a donor if a donor gets wind of it, which is where I think the resistance now needs to come from. You know, the resistance needs to come from communities themselves, who partially you don't blame them because everybody needs money to survive and to function well, but you also need to be very clear about what your objectives and roles are, and you don't want anyone else to co-opt those objectives and roles. So there's, I think it's all quote unquote local. There's local everywhere and it's doing spectacularly well. It's a matter of, you want to understand how it's doing so well, understand it, but don't take it over, because then it's gone.
And that, let's understand why it's doing so well, is part of the listening component. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge difference when you come into a community and you are curious about, how is this community already whole? How, mm-hmm. what are the thriving systems that they have that have been sustaining them for centuries, long before I'm coming in to try to fix something?
Yeah, or make it worse, actually.
Mm-hmm. and I do want to just tease out this idea of the individual versus the system. Because, you know, I think you've seen it on your own journey, I've seen it on my own journey, of individuals can find themselves in a system that is perverted and then have to make a decision whether to stay and try to fix it from within the system or to leave the system altogether. But those systems are really massive. And it's the question of, what is the responsibility of an individual? And again, I want to go back to the concept of white allyship, because I've been having many conversations with individuals, US-based individuals, who are genuinely asking, how can I make sure I don't fall into any of these same traps, usually in the context of them starting their own social initiatives. Yes, they are white, and they have ideas, they have their own unique experiences that are going to impact the world. So how can it be in a way that this individual, or actually let me backtrack a bit, Timrys, and also share, like, you know, the one conversation that's coming to mind was a white woman who had a very unique experience about sharing stories and wanted to empower others to share stories. And she was so aware of this white savior mentality that you wouldn't see her face anywhere on her website. She didn't like to do public speaking. She just saw herself as someone being behind the curtain, to the point where I think it caused that incongruence in her own system of not finding a way for her face to be present in what she is doing. So that's a very loaded question. I think that there are a lot of things underlying that, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Okay, let me just try and get my thoughts together on this one, because it is complex, right? my immediate response as an individual who is trying to fight the system from the outside is that allies are important everywhere, but white allies in particular, we still need, there's a trust deficit. Okay, so when somebody says that there are genuine white allies who have problems with this system that their, I guess, community has created, as in, you know, the rich countries of the West, and they're genuinely committed to try and changing it, I don't want to doubt that at all. You know, I think there are a lot of people who have problems with that, with the system, and they do want to change it. But the issue arises, for me at least, is that why do you want, if you want to make an impact in the world, you need to first make an impact at home. And it comes back to my point is don't ask me for solutions. Find a solution within your own context. So look inwards at your own community, at your own people. See what problems exist there and work on those problems. Once you are able to resolve those problems, if at all, then come to us and let's talk about the wider world as a whole. Because this idea that you're jumping from your own country suddenly to the rest of the world is really very illogical. And that's the whole problem, that everybody wants to do good, quote unquote, in the world, but nobody wants to do good in their own country when it comes to, you know, the white West, because everybody thinks their countries are perfect, when we know very well that they're not. And so I am a huge proponent of countries of the global South looking inwards amongst themselves to see where they are in their countries, in their histories, in their economies and societies, and tease out their own problems and come to terms with those first before moving out into the world and, you know, having a showdown with the great white North and saying, well, you know, these are the problems we have with you. And I would urge everybody from the global North to do exactly the same in their communities. Work first in resolving the attitudes your own people have towards us before you come to us and say, how do we do this? And we want to make the world a better place. We can all make the world a better place if we make our own communities a better place first. So for me, the issue is if you are having a problem in an aid system in which you work and you want to change, genuinely change it, then you start changing things from there, your end. You start challenging your superiors and your management. I've heard this so many times from young, you know, newcomers into the system, you know, in the North, saying, well, you know, management doesn't listen to us, senior management and the political side of it, they're not going to listen. Now, my problem. You want to make change? That's where you make the change first. So that's what I would say. Fight battle. That's your battle. It's not ours.
Very wise words. Incredibly wise words, Timorese. Thank you for sharing those. And I know my question wasn't clear, but I think I heard exactly what I needed to hear, because that trust deficit, you know, it's white allies coming in frustrated to these conversations because they're like, wait, but like, you know, what did I do? And the fact is it's not you, it's the system. And that trust deficit. So I'm definitely taking away the word trust deficit, as well as the importance of each person solving their problems internally. Mm-hmm. You know, each house, each family coming together. Like if my family is having an issue inside of my home, then it's really my family who needs to be working on it. And we might pull in a professional, but that's going to be up to us to pick which professional we're bringing in to help us solve our problems inside of our own house.
Yeah, and you're not going to run to another person's family to fix their problems, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So let me ask you, as we're starting to wrap up, what's giving you hope these days?
Good question. Not much. good question. Well, literally not much is giving me hope, just because of, you know, issues economic issues of my own country and just the world at large. But I think there is this innate desire to keep going somehow, because you do want to see light at the end of the tunnel. And I think coming out of the system for me showed me that light. I don't know how I'm going to get to that light. I don't know how we as a, you know, a collective are going to get to that light, if we will even get to it. But I think every little bit that I know I do in terms of resistance gives me the hope that at least I'm doing whatever little I can. You know, I mean, there are people who are doing masses, and my respect and admiration is for them and them alone. You know, I'm not even a bit player in the activism, the real activism that's happening out there on the streets and in communities and in villages. But I think looking at the fact that people are pushing back gives me hope.
And that innate desire is there. That innate desire to keep going is amazing to witness around the world.
Yeah. I mean, we have to keep going. Otherwise, what's the point, right? We might as well all just give up now.
Hope. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up? Anything we haven't touched on yet?
Lots and lots. But I guess it's about, I think the idea that there is, it's important. I mean, everybody says it's about the system and not the individuals. And I don't disagree with that. But I also think that the system is made up of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is very important to look at individual behavior as well. You can't always say that it's the system that molds the individual. It does. It molded me. But I got out of it because I figured it out eventually, right? So at the end of the day, it was an individual decision to do this. So I think this whole idea that it is just the system is there, but I think individuals also either perpetuate a system and its inequities, or they resolve them. So I think it is very important to keep the focus on individuals as well, because we all contribute in some way or the other, either negatively or positively. So if we can isolate that within us, whether we're being negative or we're being positive, that is one new addition to the system being changed.
Exactly. Exactly, and each of us being fully accountable and responsible for our individual role in that system.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And I think a lot of times what I hear is people, like if the system, I mean, I'm probably, this is, when it comes to system change, I'm not as optimistic as I would like to be, but that each individual likes to take full responsibility for what their role is and to live in congruence and alignment with what feels right to them and what they know, I think that's what's going to get us forward.
Yeah. And even that's not as easy as it sounds, because a lot of people think that, you know, no, they're doing the right thing or that they're in the right. Right. And I mean, how can you challenge an individual's personal belief in that way? They genuinely believe they're doing the right thing or that they're on the right path. So it isn't black and white, and it's a risky path to take, but nevertheless, at some point, if you don't realize that you are as much responsible for making the system what it is as much as I am or you are or the third person in the room is, we're never going to get anywhere, because then we all think we're right.
Exactly.
So long way to go. Long way to go yet, but, you know, baby steps.
Baby steps, important steps, important foundational steps. Truly, Tamrice, I think that what you and your colleagues did with this book was groundbreaking. Thank you. It gives me so much hope for where the international development sector is going.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you very much.
Of course.
That's really encouraging to hear.
So I'd like to end by asking you about the legacy that you hope to leave behind.
Oh, God, no. No legacy. I'm not in that category of leaving behind a legacy of anything. I just want to do whatever little that I can do while I'm around, in terms of, I guess, just being honest to myself, and saying what I believe in, whether people think it's right or wrong. And hopefully at some point figuring that out myself, that what I said, you know, at some point was the right thing that I said, or maybe what I said at another point in time was the wrong thing. Recognize that and move forward, knowing, keeping that in mind, and trying to do better next time.
Alrighty, friends, thank you for listening to another episode of Lighter Impact. If this resonated with you, or you're curious about what it would look like to work with a social impact coach, please do reach out to me through my website, pauseimpact.org. Till next time, wishing you little moments of lightness and impact. Have a wonderful week.